who ain't fail. Like Christ, a dirty PhD, they got nailed. Hard to breathe, sharing air with murderers and thieves. You can't leave. Situation look pale.
Welcome to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Damon Azali, and I'm here with my co-host Manuel Criollo, and this is the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. In our first segment, we will have Kim McGill, organizer with the Youth Justice Coalition, who will be talking about the long history of anti-gang legislation that leads us up to the current gang databases and gang injunctions. She'll be talking about the work they are doing to take our people back from these most wanted lists. For our second segment, we'll be joined by Jason Zindenberg, who is the executive director of the Justice Policy Institute. Jason's going to break down the federal gangbuster bills that are going through the legislature at the moment and that are trying to federalize some of the toughest local anti-gang laws. This legislation seeks to expand the death penalty, give more time to undocumented people who are convicted of crimes, and set more mandatory minimums. And for our final segment, we're going to be talking to Alfonso Gonzalez, who's a political science PhD student at UCLA and is a member of the Human Rights Committee for Homies Unidos to Stop La Mano Dura. The campaign is called Libertad con Dignidad. So before we get to Kim McGill, I want to say that I've been wanting to do this show for a long time. One thing that keeps striking me over and over again is that the prison construction boom in this country is fueled by laws that get people caught up, keep them caught up, and keep getting them scooped up by the law enforcement. Three strikes, mandatory minimums, and anti-gang legislation checks them in, and petty parole violations and interaction with cops, etc., never lets them get out. The prison construction boom might be a rather recent thing, say, the last 3 decades or so. The targeting of oppressed nationality peoples in this country has been going on since its inception. The anti-gang statute started in the 1800s as a way to criminalize and go after the bandidos, and these were Mexicanos who were fighting back against occupation and the annexation of Mexico to the U.S. It follows through to the 20s with the Zoot Suiters, the 60s with the Black and Chicano Power movements, and on to the present-day gang injunctions with 18th Street gangs in the Rolling 60s. This is all undergirded by the constant media rantings of super predators that would have you believe that there's a Black or Salvadoreño gangster, as we speak, hiding in the bushes, waiting to jack you for your Lexus SUV as you're taking the kids to the local soccer game. So now you have Newsweek with an article on MS-13, Mara Salvatrucha 13, the gang that is reported to have more clicks and connections than Al Capone had. And better yet, they're all legal immigrants, aka terrorist threats. L.A. Police Chief Braddon said that gangs are the worst thing since the mob. They're all domestic terrorists. I would say to Billy to pump the brakes, this rhetoric dovetails nicely with the federal legislation that is underway. It gives more money to outfit and militarize the police, money for national databases to keep folks under tabs, and 5 to 10 year enhancement for people who are convicted of crimes that don't have papers. I guess we'll end with this before we bring Kim on. All the five major mayoral candidates talked about more cops and tougher laws. This is happening on the local level, the state level, and the federal level. This momentum is helping to pull even the most progressive politicians, to the right. And today our guests are going to tell you what they're going to be doing to reverse this trend. So on the phone joining us today, we'll have Kim McGill, who is an organizer with the Youth Justice Coalition. Last week I heard her break down the history of anti-gang legislation that has been in development since the 1800s, and wanted to bring her on the show to talk about that as well as the YJC, the Youth Justice Coalition's campaign, to purge people from gang databases, as well as force the closure of the California Youth Authority. So, Kim, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. So why don't you start off with doing a brief couple minutes on the history of the gang latest legislation as you did about a week ago.
Well, I guess you could say its earlier stages was back in the 1800s after the war where the U.S. annexed this land from Mexico. A lot of people that had been living here for centuries, their families had been living here for centuries, but were considered Mexican nationals, called Mexican nationals, were losing their land. It was being confiscated from them really illegally. And so the original kind of use of the term of gang to signify something criminal, which really wasn't criminal, which was more about self-defense or defense of land, was around Mexicans trying to hold onto their land here in the L.A. area. And they were right away labeled as bandito groups. And at that time, L.A. actually had the highest lynching rate in the country. And it was primarily people that were really Californians but were labeled as Mexicans getting lynched illegally, and as well as so-called legal lynchings. So that's like L.A.'s earliest use of, I guess you could say, gang profiling. And then, of course, people are more familiar with the use of gang tactics and gang labeling around the so-called boot suit riots, which were really more sailor riots around World War II. And once the 50s and 60s started, then you start to see, you know, real labeling of all kinds of groups of young people of color as gang members. And when you really start to see it, I guess you could say, institutionalized in California state law is in the early to mid-80s. That's kind of its earliest history.
Okay. And then a lot of that also kind of transforms around the federal level when you have the Clinton crime bill, et cetera. So maybe you can...
Yeah, even before the Clinton crime bill, the earliest stuff that was put into place was around kind of the IRS and FBI's tactics against organized crime. And so early on, probably as early as the 50s, you start to see street gang members being labeled also as organized crime, so that organized criminals, so that you could apply federal statutes that were really created to address the mafia towards street gangs also. And so starting again, it really escalated in the 80s and 90s, using, say, federal RICO charges against what were really local street gangs. And the way they, in some cases, legitimately used it from a legal perspective, and in other cases illegitimately used it, was that there were gang members who were crossing state lines, or alleged gang members who were taking their business nationally. So that's how they started to apply federal law to what were not really organized, you know, like in the sense of mafia organized crime groups, but were they used the same laws to apply to them.
Okay.
And then the Clinton crime bill, it's right after the World Trade Center bombing in 94, the Clinton passed this crime bill, and that was the first kind of national legislation that looked seriously at mandatory minimums, greatly expanded the federal prison system, and started to take the stuff that was happening in California around gang legislation and gang tactics nationally, adopted a lot of what we had in California.
So right now there's this kind of pattern that's been going on for a while, and then there's this upcoming or actually in-process gangbusters bill on the federal level, which our next guest is going to be talking a little bit more about. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is there – I know some of our members went to the Malcolm X Festival and heard about this thing called Nutcracker, and I wanted to see if you knew any more information about that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think most of us are kind of in the dark about the realities of it and where it's originating from, or if it's even real or just kind of a rumor. But I could tell you that the tactics that are outlined in the Nutcracker concept paper are not too different from the tactics that both the Patriot Act put in place to happen and Bratton and other local law enforcement officials have been saying could happen in L.A. County. So even if Nutcracker ends up being kind of just a rumor that doesn't come true, I think there's a lot in it that rings true for what's already happening around law enforcement. For people in California, the most important thing to know about the Patriot Act is that when Clinton's crime bill came into place in 94 and then the Patriot Act came into place in 2001, both spoke around issues around terrorism. But California in 1987 had already passed the STEP Act, which was it's basically in California's Penal Code 18620, so if anyone wanted to look it up, it's all there. And the STEP Act is called the Street Terrorism Enforcement Program. And basically that's the California Act that defined a gang and also labeled a gang as a street terrorist. So any federal legislation that came after, both Clinton's crime bill and the Patriot Act, can automatically get applied to anyone that's on the gang file in any county in California. What that means for us locally here in L.A. and throughout California is that Patriot Act things around being able to be detained without charges, being able to be deported without due process, those kind of issues that happen for so-called alleged international terrorism can also be applied to local, anyone who's on the gang database. As already, you know, again, to be put on the database, you don't have to prove gang membership. It's just alleged gang membership, but then you can have criminal sanctions against people based on that. So I think that's what's most important to know about the Patriot Act here locally. It really becomes a Department of Homeboy Security as opposed to a Department of Homeland Security. And for the Operation Nutcracker, there's a leaked concept paper that's kind of floating around L.A. right now. When Homeland Security was put into place, one of the things they talked about was using coordinated law enforcement tactics as a way to do policing, both locally, nationally, and internationally. So they talked, both, you know, in the Patriot Act and in the creation of Homeland Security, of coordination between ATF, FBI, local law enforcement, Marshal's Office, et cetera. And really, recently, like within the last month and a half, the U.S. Marshals used this kind of coordinated law enforcement strategy to go after felony fugitives. And they kind of proved that when you had all these federal offices coordinating with local law enforcement around a certain number of individuals, their arrest numbers skyrocketed, and they claimed that their confiscation of drugs and weapons skyrocketed also during that two-week period that they had it in place. So what's happening in terms of the Nutcracker paper is that it's proposing a similar kind of law enforcement strategy of bringing together FBI, ATF, local law enforcement, the military, National Guard, to work in a coordinated way, not around felony fugitives, but around local gang members. And because we already have a system in LA County of using gang injunctions, which puts certain communities, if you're named in the injunction, pretty much on a martial law, that kind of a policy would be really easy for them to implement in those neighborhoods especially. So I think we should dig for further information and try to find out if Nutcracker is actually true or if it's just a rumor. But I think we should also expect that Nutcracker-like tactics are already in place and that California, especially with the STEP Act, is just primed to be able to use the Patriot Act against young people and community members, especially those who are on a gang file. In that kind of coordinated law enforcement way.
So in terms of, like, the gang file, in terms of gang databases and gang injunctions, how do folks get on that? How do police use those?
Well, the first thing to know is that I think there's a lot of confusion about the fact that some people see those things as legislative strategies. But, in fact, they're police tactic strategies. And it's partly legislative because when the STEP Act came into place, it gave California's definition of a gang. It listed specific crimes as examples of criminal gang activity, and it made, most importantly, it made belonging to a gang a criminal offense. So California became the first state where just belonging to a gang became a criminal offense. And right before the STEP Act was passed in 88, you started to see the first use of gang databases in L.A. County. It was first, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department was actually the first law enforcement group that started to use this computerized gang database. And what that is a police strategy. It didn't require legislation. It's seen by police as a way to gain intelligence, so they don't even claim that they are required to show the database to anybody. The only people who have real access to it are law enforcement. And what they basically do is they'll come up to you on the street, and again, when I say you, I'm talking primarily about younger people, black and brown, in some communities, Asians and poor whites, but it's primarily a tactic used against poor people and people of color. And I'm sure people know that, but under the gang definition in California, the Enron executives would be considered a gang, but they're not prosecuted as gang members. The Rampart officers would be considered a gang under that definition. It's any group of three or more people acting together to commit a crime, but they certainly weren't, you know, prosecuted as gang members. So it's clear, not in the definition, but in the way that the policy's played out, who gets targeted. A police officer comes up to you and asks you, they can ask anything. Even if you're 8, 9, 10 years old, they have the right, under regular standard law, to ask anybody any question they want. They can ask you where you're from, what set you claim, who's your friends, who you hang out with, who's in your family, what are their nicknames, what's your nickname, all of that. And just based on that interview, they can suppose in their head whether or not you belong to a gang. They don't have to ask you if you're gang involved. They don't have to ask your parents. They don't have to dig for any other information.
And then all that gets put into the database.
Yeah, they take that information. They fill out what's called a field identification card. If they're a gang officer, they can put that information directly onto their local database. And if they're not, they'll hand it over to a gang officer in their department, in their station. And they'll determine whether or not it should go in the database. Those local databases are all linked, starting in the early 90s, in California at the CalGang database, which is the Department of Justice's database. And so now if you're stopped in Sacramento and you've been put on the database from Inglewood, then they're going to just assume you'll be down as a known gang member from LA County. When you're put on the database, you're not notified. There's no right to an appeal process. Those are things we're fighting for. There's no clear way of ever getting off of it. They say that they'll take you off after 5 years if there's no other police contact. But police contact would include walking across the street and having a police officer stop you. You don't even have to get a ticket for it to be counted as police contact. And then that would start another 5-year cycle. And then when people get taken off, they're not notified of the fact they're taken off, so we don't even have any proof that they claim they just took thousands of people off the database. But when we met with Bratton, he wouldn't give us the names of those people. We asked if we could notify them. He said he didn't think that would be possible. So there's just no clear process for getting on, for getting off, for appealing it, no right to due process or anything.
And then what does that do if you were convicted of committing a crime and you are on the database? Like, how does that enhance it or put more years on it or change the penalties?
Well, a lot of people, that's how they find out that they're on the database. They get picked up for something minor or something serious, it doesn't really matter. And when they get into court, it comes out that they're an alleged gang member. And usually in court, they don't say even alleged. They'll say he's a known gang member. And they'll be like, what are you talking about? And it'll come out that they're on the database. That's how a lot of people find out. And once you're on that database, then you're subject to gang enhancements, which are in addition to your, if you're prosecuted for a crime and you get a certain sentence, they found guilty, they can add enhancements based on the fact you're on the database and claim that it was a gang crime. And the enhancements are up to 10 years. So it's a significant amount of time that they can add for something that they never really had to prove you were gang involved. In order to put an enhancement on, they'll also bring the so-called gang experts into court to testify that you are gang members. But a lot of that testimony has been really shaky, and juries are so afraid and also so ignorant to the issues that a lot of times the testimony from a police officer, which is really shaky, doesn't sound shaky to them, and they just kind of take it as truth, and enhancements almost always get added based on that.
So
the other thing that it subjects you to is that once you're on the gang file, then you're subjected to gang injunctions. And a gang injunction is basically a civil court order against certain members of an alleged, I always use the term alleged because they never have to prove your gang involvement. And to get on the gang database, you have to have committed a crime. So to me, everyone on the gang file is an alleged gang member. But basically, they'll take certain names from a neighborhood and they'll serve them with a restraining order, a civil court order. So that means that when you're put on a gang injunction, you're served a pack of papers with a court date, but because it's a civil court order, you don't have any right to legal representation. So most people don't know they can fight it, and if they do try to fight it, don't have the legal representation to really fight it well. And once the judge sees that either no one's in court to challenge the injunction, or the people in court can't really defend themselves against the injunction, then it becomes a permanent injunction, and injunctions never go away. They're literally permanent. Some of them have been around now for 20 years, the ones that first came into L.A. County in the early to mid-'80s.
So we're on the phone speaking with Kim McGill, who is with the Youth Justice Coalition, and this is KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. And Kim, why don't you tell us a little bit about what YJC is actually doing to fight the databases and injunctions?
Well, our long-term goal or vision would be to do away with gang injunctions and gang databases altogether. We think they're very costly. They're not, even by police, very accurate. And they really criminalize people and deny people major violations to their constitutional rights. So we think there's many better ways, more cost-effective ways, and more humane ways to hold down safety in communities. So that would be our long-term goal. But short-term, we're trying to make some changes that we think are more possible politically right now. For the gang database, we want people to have the right to notification, the right to an appeal process, the right, if they're under 18, to also have their parents notified, and the right, if they aren't arrested for a gang-related offense within 18 months, the right to have their name removed from the database. With gang injunctions, right now, if you're in a gang injunction area, there's certain stipulations that if you don't follow, you can get 6 to 12 months jail time. Again, even though it's a civil court order, and these are not criminal violations of the law, you can still do jail time behind it, or prison time behind it. So an example of that would be in many injunctions, if you're carrying a beeper or a cell phone and you're stopped, your name and the injunction, you're stopped, you get 6 to 12 months. If you're in a space or in public transportation or on the street with another known gang member, someone else is on the database, not necessarily someone else named in the injunction, then you can get violated, even if it's your own brother that you're walking down the street with or your father. If you're out past a curfew that they set, you can get violated. So what we're arguing is that people should not be violated if they're doing something like a job training program, an after-school program, a church-based program. We want exemptions in the gang injunctions for all public transportation and all community-based programs. The only things that are exempt right now are schools, if you're enrolled in the school, so a public school if you're a student there, and a church service. But all other church programs and all other community programs are not exempt. So a lot of people either don't go or are violated on the way to the programs or violated outside, you know, as they're waiting to go into the programs, et cetera.
Kim, this is Manuel Criollo. And, you know, one thing that makes me think a lot about as an organizer, you know, when I'm on the bus and we talk a lot around, you know, sort of the growing criminal, you know, justice system and how almost sort of every aspect of life is being criminalized. How's the conversation with Black and Latino families and communities? Because in many ways, they become huge advocates for more police. They become huge advocates for things like gang injunctions. You know, do you have even the conversation? Last time we had this guy who wrote this book, Our Enemies in Blue, and talked about how even the whole concept of the police state was built to find escaped slaves, and now that you're talking about the anti-gang laws, you know, how that's connected to, you know, the rise of the occupation of Mexico. What's the conversation that you're having with the communities, given that these are the very same communities that at times are advocating hard for these kind of measures?
I mean, I think it's going to be a long conversation and as well a healing process that's going to happen in communities. What we're doing locally, and Youth Justice Coalition is very small, so we're not even trying to pretend that we're doing this on a huge level. But our chapters inside Juvenile Hall, the young people talked about a code of conduct for YJC members, and they created it. And we're trying to hold ourselves accountable for that, which includes, one, not calling the police unless it's to save a life, so that we would try to handle conflicts in our communities differently than calling on the police. But then also knowing that it's our responsibility to hold down public safety. So some of the codes include not making money in any way that harms our communities or our families. So challenging people when they're dealing, for example, with drug trafficking does to our communities. Even if it's survival, we understand people are doing a lot of stuff to survive. But that our own personal survival should not mean the detriment or the destruction of another person or another family in our communities, in addition to holding ourselves accountable for our own actions. We need to start also talking about how we can build alternatives to police and prison systems in our own communities. So we've been real critical of the fact that LA County spends very little money on alternatives to detention, incarceration, arrest, and court, especially in comparison to other counties as well as other countries in the world, which are far ahead of us on this, on restorative justice principles. And so we're pushing that in LA County, for every dollar they spend to lock a person up, they spend an equal or greater amount on building community-based, owned, and operated alternatives. We're trying to figure out how we can get people out of LA County to see what those alternatives look like. We're trying to build a map on our website that people can link to other places in the country and the world where real innovative things are going on. We have all of this stuff in our history. Almost every indigenous community in the world, it doesn't matter if your indigenous community was in Latin America, North America, Africa, Europe, they almost all ran on the restorative justice principles, and we've lost that. So we're not pretending that people don't have the answers in their own histories. We just want to link people to those answers and start getting people to think creatively about how we can hold down safety in our communities without just giving in to a prison system, which in the end makes our communities bankrupt and less safe and leads to a lot of the kind of racist slave trade that we're recreating with those systems.
Kim, this is Kim McGill from Youth Justice Coalition. Do you guys have any events coming up, and how can people get in contact with you?
Well, as part of this, we're trying to shut down the California Youth Authority for Young People. I'm sure most listeners, KPFK, know that 4 young people died last year in CYA, and there's groups all over the state that are trying to shut down CYA. So our next action is targeting Arnold Schwarzenegger. It'll be on June 17th. We don't have a location totally set yet, but I'm quite sure it'll be at Youth Opportunities Unlimited, which is on Vermont in Manchester. It'll be at 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. on that day. And basically what we're going to do is put Arnold Schwarzenegger on trial. Our members are creating a trial where those of them that have experienced CYA and some of the parents that have experienced CYA are going to talk about the conditions they've faced and hold a mock election to hold the governor accountable for the fact that he's not shut down CYA. He's talking about reform of CYA. We don't believe that can be reformed. It needs to be shut down. Locally in L.A. County, we're working very closely with Probation Chief Paul Higa to create, take some of the camp spaces in our local probation camps and turn them into local CYA alternatives so we can start to build a different system here in L.A. County.
Can you give us a number and other ways to contact you, Kim?
Yeah, there's our phone number you can reach us at is 323-321-9017. You can also email us at freelanow@yahoo.com. That's freelanow at yahoo.com. And we have countywide meetings every month. Everyone in L.A. is welcome to come. If you email us, we'll send you out all of our emails on
Thank you.
Events.
Thank you, Kim McGill, organizer of the Youth Justice Coalition. Stay tuned. We're going to talk to Jason Seinenberg, a criminal justice researcher, just to continue this conversation.
Mr. Coke said to Mr. Mayor, you know we got a process like I can't care. We put up the fund for your election campaign.